Hey everyone, this is Adam Ellenboss from Nightlight Astrology, and today we are going to continue our exploration of Jupiter and Uranus. Their upcoming conjunction takes place on April 20th. This is like Jupiter-Uranus week on the interwebs. And on my channel, for sure, we've been looking at Jupiter-Uranus going back to last week. We took some time to look at Jupiter-Uranus in terms of the mundane, historical, collective expressions, linking those back to our personal lives. We took some time yesterday to explore the previous conjunctions and oppositions of Jupiter and Uranus, and you can track those biographically, which helps a lot when it comes to understanding the upcoming conjunction. So go back to yesterday's video if you haven't seen that one yet. Today, I want to talk about Jupiter and Uranus from the standpoint of the soul and its evolutionary journey. When I started off as an astrologer for the first 4 or 5 years of my practice, I practiced evolutionary astrology. I've taken a turn toward Hellenistic, and my philosophical values are not 100% in line with evolutionary astrology, but there's a lot of really good things that I take from my time practicing evolutionary astrology. And also, there are many philosophical similarities between evolutionary astrology and ancient Indian astrology, ancient Hellenistic astrology. So today we're going to talk about how the Jupiter-Uranus dynamic can be understood from the perspective of the soul and its journey through space and time, through so many lifetimes, and what kind of moment this constitutes for the evolution of the soul, if you choose to think about it that way. And if not, you can at least entertain this as an interesting, you know, a kind of metaphorical lens through which to look at the transit. So anyway, that's our goal for today. As always, before we get into it, don't forget to like and subscribe. Share your comments and reflections, especially if you have a good story to share this week. Use the hashtag grabbed. Tell us the name of the transit if it's Jupiter-Uranus, and then tell us your story. Be concise. Don't share anything you don't want us sharing in a future storytelling episode. You could also email us your story to grabbed@nightlightastrology.com. You can find a transcript of today's talk on the website. So, speaking of that, I will take you over there right now. We are running a couple of promotions right at this time. The first one, actually, I want to take you over to is my wife's website. Ashley is a regular guest on the show. She helps us look at the connection between planets and plants. Plant spirit medicine is a really fascinating topic. If you are interested, her herbal apprenticeship begins on April 24th. It's a one-year course in herbal plant spirit medicine. Great program. It is all remote, so you can follow along at your own pace. There are meetups for tutoring and group classes that meet, but the major units of study are all recorded and housed on a class website so that you can take it at your own pace. So check that out. Starts April 24th. There's need-based tuition available for that, just like all of my programs. On that note, I'll take you over to my page now, and you can see on nightlightastrology.com, live talk coming up. We have this Thursday, Uranus in love. So if you want to learn more about the significations of the planet Uranus when it shows up in love and relationships in the birth chart or by transits of the birth chart, we are exploring that Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern. It is a $20 registration cost, and then you get the link to join live. If you can't attend live, we send you the recording. So check that out. Really great to explore the outer planets in love and relationships. We've done Pluto, we've done Neptune. You can pick up the recordings of those talks. Join us Thursday night for the last in this series. And then you'll notice that the next three webinars, May, June, and July, are scheduled and the talks are up. You can register for those as well. We're doing Neptune and Aries in May, the 12th house. We're going to be looking at the 12th house in depth in June. We're going to be talking about Uranus's movement into Gemini in July, even though those outer planetary movements are a little ways off. We're going to be exploring those in these upcoming talks. Check those out, register for them. You get the live link. If you can't make it, you get the recording. And then go to the courses page. Our first year class, Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystic, begins June 16th. Our year two program begins in June. Our horary astrology program begins in June. You can check all of those out on the courses page. We have need-based tuition available for all of these one-year programs. There's 30 classes on the year. They're all held via webinar. If you can't attend live, they're all recorded and held on a class website. There is a ton of bonus material, a ton of quizzes, flashcards, an optional certification exam at the end if you're thinking about going professional. If this is just for your hobby, you can really take this class at whatever level of depth you want. We provide enough material for people who are really intense and they want to go full on professional. We have this for people, you know, it's accessible for people at all levels of interest or seriousness. There's an interactive group forum discussion. We have breakout study sessions with tutors. So it is a very well-structured program. Deep dive into ancient astrology. You'll find the early bird payment saves you significantly on the cost of the program. That is only available until May 1st. So be sure to take advantage of that before May 1st. There's also an early bird installment plan where you can use 12 monthly payments. That is also only available until May 1st, at which point those prices go up. We do have need-based assistance. So if you are someone who would like to check out the need-based tuition option, just click on apply now and we give you the option to choose between a few different sliding scale price points for people who need a little help, because we don't want people living outside of their means. We know that there is great socioeconomic diversity out there, and we want to be sure that the class is accessible. So if you could use that, be sure to check it out. Otherwise, we ask people to, you know, use our normal prices if you can afford them. Okay. So anyway, any questions about those programs, you can email us info@nightlightastrology.com. Otherwise, stick around after today's content. You can hear an in-depth exploration of the class and what it includes. Okay, now on to our Jupiter-Uranus talk for the day. Let us take a look at the, here's the contact between the two of them coming up, and it is Saturday, April 20th, that the two planets conjoin. So we're partway through the week here, and we are well on our way to this conjunction. They're now on the same degree. I've got the moon today actually squaring the two planets, so there's an activation of it in the sky already. Sun is about to enter Taurus. It's going to square Pluto as it does so. That is happening just the day after. So like this weekend, we have the Sun square Pluto right after Jupiter and Uranus get together. It's a big weekend. Anyhow, so today what I want to do is I want to talk about three soul-based takes on the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction. What I mean by soul-based is the idea that you are an evolving soul, a soul that is learning, growing, changing, shifting, exploring lifetime to lifetime over the course of many lifetimes, perhaps innumerable, perhaps without beginning or end. I don't have the details or the specifics on how it all works, but I do happen to believe, as ancient astrologers did, that the soul is an eternal being that is part and parcel of the divine whole, and that the soul moves from lifetime to lifetime, exploring life, exploring desires, exploring all sorts of different relationships and scenarios and wishes and hopes and different kinds of suffering that we endure along the way as well. And that it is beautiful, artistic, enjoyable, relational, sensual, and also highly educational. And so from that soul-based perspective, an evolutionary soul-based perspective, how can we understand the conjunction of Jupiter and Uranus? They happen every 14 years or so. It's not like they never happen. But what do we make of them? What kind of milestone does the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction represent in terms of the journey of the soul? I think this is important to think about. In fact, one of the things that I've been excited about is I've been speaking at length with a colleague of mine that I've known since the very first year I started practicing astrology. His name's Ari Moshe Wolf. He's an old friend of mine who's an evolutionary astrologer. And we've been talking about collaborating for a series, maybe this summer, maybe in the fall, that explores the interconnectedness between the philosophies of ancient astrology and evolutionary astrology, also drawing some of the distinctions out and talking about them. Anyway, I think that that kind of stuff is fascinating. I practiced evolutionary astrology for, first probably about 4 years of my career. I was primarily following a lot of the work of Stephen Forrest, to a lesser extent, Jeffrey Wolf Green, mostly Stephen Forrest, and the evolutionary perspective. Now, my perspective has changed quite a bit, and I have a very different view of the nodes now that's more in line with what ancient astrologers had to say about them and so on and so forth. But the basic idea that the soul is evolving, that the birth chart is a reflection of the life that a soul is living, given various desires and evolutionary adventures, is still very much a part of how I see charts. Now, from that standpoint, I think there are some really basic and, helpful things that we can say about Jupiter and Uranus conjoining this week and what it might mean for the evolution of the soul. So number one, the soul likes what is familiar. Now, this is something that I take from a lot of what the archetypal psychology movement has had to say about the soul, thinking about Jung, Hillman, and the entire world of archetypal psychologists and what they've said about the soul. The soul, you can think about the soul. There's two images that come to mind in describing the difference between the word spirit and the word soul in the world of archetypal psychology. The spirit is likened into the top of a mountain. It's like a little ashram at the top of a mountain. And when you think about the soul, you think about the village that's resting in the valley down below the mountain near the banks of a river. You know, valley life is about worldly life. It's about immanence. It's about the yin. It's about participation. It's about earth. It's about embodiment, sensuality, earthly relationships. It's about being a citizen of earth. And it's about feeling at home in life, in mortality, in the immediacy of things like family and a dog and a cat, and your body and the adventures of your specific life with this specific body and this specific ego on planet Earth. That is the soul. The soul is the part of us that seeks to live stories. And stories are about, so much of what stories involve have to do with belonging and love and connection, as well as the realization of various desires that we have that connect us to things that we value in the world, whether that desire is, sexual or artistic or has something to do with a profession, or even, all of the power trips we get on. I want to be powerful or whatever. The world is the arena in which we explore our desires, our desire to live an embodied life. Now, spirit is that impulse in us. It's paired with the soul. They're two parts of what we are as eternal beings, you could say. It's like we're dyadic creatures. And the spirit part of us from this perspective is the part that wants us to transcend the world. This might be about the desire to leave behind all worldly adventures and merge with the total oneness of Godhead or something like that, right? So you go up to the top of the mountain, you leave the world behind to get a higher perspective. And this, we do this all the time in a very everyday sense. It's like if you have a meditation practice or any kind of practice that allows you some reflective distance from your life, you're walking up the top of the hill compared to being in the valley and you're getting some reflective distance. Or you're going all the way up to the top of the ashram and maybe at the top of the mountain and maybe you're reflecting on the desire to be free from ever reincarnating again, right? But that function, the transcendental function, the function that wants to move us up and out of the valley, we call that spirit in archetypal psychology, and we call soul the desire to inhabit and be part of the embodied matrix of life, ecological, like that. So the soul likes what is familiar. What do we mean by that? We mean to say that the soul likes the familiarity of the world. You know, for me, for example, I would say if I had to describe the features of my life that are most soul-like, it would be my family, my kids, my wife, my dog, my house, my little routines, the things I like doing, the things that I do to participate in the world, the sports team I follow. So there's something about the soul that likes to attach. Like I like to bond and attach, which is another way of saying that I like what is familiar. The soul likes to get close and comfortable with things and attach to things that it loves, and in that way create a feeling of being at home. Now we know that in the embodied material universe, that can't last forever. There, impermanence, time is undefeated, that everyone dies, everything passes away. Which is why we also need a transcendent function, right? We also need to remember eternity. We need to remember impermanence and death. And we remember that life goes on beyond the bonds and attachments that we have in this world. And if we are so attached that we forget that, letting go becomes really difficult and often extremely painful. Love, pain is and suffering are in part the cost of love. And that there's something very interesting about that. And we always tell people spiritually, you can't just bypass the need to attach deeply in love to your body, to your dog, to your family, to your friends, to things in the world. Because part of what we're here to do is exactly that. So the soul likes its attachments and its connections, and there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, some are obviously more unhealthy than others. Obviously, on an ideal level, the soul should be attaching to things that are healthy, and it should be holding them with some sense that, eventually these things will pass, and that's a part of life, and that's okay. Well, that's a good marriage of the spirit and soul together, right? But in terms of like the soul's evolution, as it participates in the world, there comes periods of time in which suddenly we have to leave behind attachments, and or attachments need to change. For example, let's just use the most mundane example you could possibly think of. You like to drink coffee every morning and you have 3-4 cups a day. And maybe, you know, it's a lot of people out there who like really love their coffee. And then we're talking about Taurus too, a sign that Jupiter and Uranus is getting together in, a earth sign, solid earth sign, sign of Venus. A cup of coffee in the morning is very Taurus, right? Especially if you like it every day. This is your attachment. For many people, there will come a moment where you realize, oh my gosh, you know, coffee is making me anxious, or coffee is something that is no longer, doesn't feel like it's aligned anymore. People say stuff like this, right? And I'm not judging coffee at all. I drink coffee in the morning. I drink one cup a day, but that's plenty for me. Otherwise I go a little bit crazy. But so let's just say though, that you get to this point where you're like, okay, now it's time for me to let go of coffee. You let go of it because you have the sense that something can't keep going on in the same way. And because you let go of coffee, let's say suddenly you feel more peaceful in the mornings, you realize, oh, it was actually, at one point it was a good thing, then it became an anxiety provoking thing, and now it's out of my lifestyle and I feel a lot better. And because you feel better, you have more motivation, or there's more peacefulness, and so you're able, new opportunities present themselves. This is Jupiter Uranus. Whatever the soul is attached to, whether it's a person, a place, a thing, ideas in your own head, psychological complexes, there are rhythmic seasons in life. Here, life in the valley, the soul life, where the things that we have been attached to suddenly have to be let go of in order for new things to be explored, new possibilities to be opened. Jupiter Uranus is, in a sense, like someone saying, setting down their coffee mug and saying, I need a trip to the top of the mountain. I'm not going to stay there forever, but I need a trip up there. And when I go up there and I see the whole world below and I get this transcendental perspective, man, new possibilities open. Now I walk back down the mountain into the valley, right? It's like, you're not like we're going to abandon. I mean, Jupiter Uranus could represent the impulse to abandon the world altogether, because it can get very, I don't know, like transcendentally manic or something like that. But you come back down into the world, and having had this breakthrough mountaintop high, remember Jupiter Uranus is associated with traveling to the moon, the moon landing. That perspective of leaving the familiar and going beyond, that is what the soul is seeking right now, because it has reached, you could say it has reached a stage in which certain facets of the familiar are done. They've reached their expiration and they're no longer useful. You could say they're no longer serving me or whatever. I don't always like that language, but you get what I'm saying. It's like they're done. They're not useful anymore, or they might even be representing something stagnant or inert, or something that if you keep holding on to, you won't grow or you'll be held back. And suddenly in the enticing possibility of something new is coming up, such that if I let go of various attachments and go into something brand new, there's, you know, new like vistas, there's new possibilities. So one way of thinking about what Jupiter Uranus represents from the soul-based evolutionary perspective is that it represents an opportunity to let go of various familiar fixed things, specifically in Taurus, those things that relate to Venus: love, desire, beauty, sex, pleasure, luxury, enjoyment, peace, stability, ease, harmony, all of those, whatever you have been doing to try and establish those things. It is as though right now, if you let go of some of the way that you've been doing things, then the possibility for something very different, very, very healing, very, you could actually enhance your pleasure. I mean, I'm the kind of person who goes to a restaurant and I order the same thing all the time. I'm a Taurus rising, because I know that I'll be happy with that. And I don't know if I'll be happy with something else, and I don't want the risk. But this is exactly the moment where Jupiter Uranus moments are, where the soul goes to the menu of life and says, it might be a risk, but I could find something that's even better. You have to try that. If you don't, you know what you'll get from the same old thing, but there's less happiness. Over time, doing the same things over and over, there's less happiness. Now, sometimes in the name of doing things that are brand new, there's more destruction or revolution. There's more bloodshed in the act or wake of revolution than there are at other times in life. Depending on how it's configured in your chart, the revolution might be a little bit messier or more destructive. But that usually comes with the kinds of attachments we're having to let go of in order to allow for the new possibilities. So, you know, it doesn't have to be like a destructive thing, though. It can be a very inspired thing, but there is usually a sense of like, in order to do this, I have to let go of something familiar. Number two, the soul is interested in novelty. One of the things that we can say about the soul is that for as much as the soul likes to develop its attachments, the things that make it feel safe and at home and happy and fulfilled when it's in an embodied form, like a human body, the other thing that it likes is novelty. Here's the thing, is that the soul is always interested in seeing itself. We see ourselves and we know ourselves and we come to love ourselves through the mirror of our relationships, through the mirror of our social functions, whether it's our profession or the reputation we develop. We know ourselves through spiritual reflection. We know ourselves through our children, or we know ourselves through communities that we belong to. And when we bring new people, new communities, new dynamics into our life, one of the things that the soul loves about that is that those relationships, those people, places, and things provide new mirrors by means of which to see ourselves in new ways. And for as much as the soul loves its attachments, the soul is a great mystery even unto itself. Heraclitus once said, "The soul is explored forever to a depth beyond report." One of the reasons that the soul loves coming into forms and bodies is because it provides endless ways for the soul to know itself, love itself, see itself. It's like a hide and seek game, and each lifetime and each new situation provides us with new ways of finding the hidden pieces of ourselves that are so majestic that you have to go looking for somehow in the valley of the world to find. Well, that means that Jupiter-Uranus dynamics are especially exciting in the way that they bring new things into our life rapidly, suddenly, by means of which we get to see our souls in new ways. And the soul just craves that. If you get stuck in what's familiar for too long, you only get to see yourself in certain ways. And eventually the soul gets sick of that. So Jupiter-Uranus, novelty. Novelty is the new way that we get to see the soul. Three, new states of consciousness bring new resources. Here's the thing. When we try something new and we leave what's familiar in our lives here in the valley, when we find new reflections and novel new people, places, and things by means of which to see ourselves, and the glory of the soul sort of reveals itself in a whole new way all over again. Wow, it's so beautiful. But here's what happens, is that our consciousness changes. A consciousness is like a reflection of the change of the soul. They're like mirrors for one another. When our consciousness changes because we're seeing new parts of our soul, we're taking risks and doing new things in different areas of our lives, that brings a new state of consciousness. And with all of that brings new resources. We'll have oftentimes, in other words, what will accompany such changes will be that there are new teachers that enter our life, new subjects that enter our life, new lovers that enter our life, or new levels of depth available to us in our existing relationships. There will be new ways in which we are able to see things, which in turn gift us with new tools that we can use. It's as though every time we get to know ourselves in a brand new way, we let go of old attachments and we try on new habits and behaviors, that they provide us with new tools and resources that we can use and explore with. I'll just say, for example, that, you know, when I first started working with psychedelic medicines in sacred ceremonial contexts, of course, ayahuasca, South Central American traditions, these traditions, although they were, you know, in a sense that the ayahuasca tradition that I was initially a part of was very specific. It was, you know, from South America. It was, you know, it didn't have anything to do with a huge amount of secondary subjects that started pouring into my life because I took a risk and tried this new experience. From those experiences, I started meeting people who reflected different interests, who were also taking new and different risks with the development of their lives. And so I learned about yoga. So I learned about astrology. You know, I learned so many things. So when we change our consciousness, because we change the people, places, and things in our lives that are most familiar, we take some risks, we let go of some attachments, we open ourselves up to newness, all of a sudden, lots of new things start pouring in. It's never just the initial new choice. The choice becomes like a, it's like a domino effect. Well, I'm gonna take a risk with a new kind of job, or I'm gonna take a risk and get out of a relationship that maybe hasn't been a real healthy one or something like that. You find that that choice not only results in you feeling maybe like, oh, I'm single again because I got out of a dating relationship with someone who was sitting on their hands, they wouldn't commit. You know, so I took the risk and I got out. It was familiar, it was safe, it was like a menu item that I knew, but I'm taking that risk and getting out of the relationship. Okay, well, now you're free and single and you might have some nice dates, but guess what else happens? Because you made that choice, suddenly a new group or a new community comes into your life. Suddenly yoga teacher training comes into your life. These are the kinds of things that I'm used to seeing because we ran a yoga studio for a long time. When people take risks and explore new uncharted terrain within themselves, and there's a desire to see something new, to have a little personal awakening and revolution, you cannot possibly predict all of the new kinds of people and things that start pouring in from other directions. And those are the new resources that reflect the new consciousness. These are all things that apparently the soul is interested in. And even though these experiences seem like, you know, these revolutions are so, in some ways, so unpredictable, yet we get them every 14 years. You know, we get a Jupiter-Uranus conjunction every 14 years. So there's something there on one level, it's like there's nothing new under heaven, you know, as like they say in the Old Testament, like nothing new under the sun. And yet the soul, as it is journeying through the valley of life, through the embodied material universe, this beautiful place that's facilitating our exploration of life itself, this place also seems to honor the rhythmic need that we have to establish deep connections and attachments, and then to, at certain times, let go of some of them in order to, you know, revolutionize and be free and bring in something new. It's just a beautiful dynamic if you think about it on that level. So anyway, that's what I wanted to share today. I hope that this was helpful. Stick around after I sign off if you want to learn more about the upcoming program, Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystic, starts June 16th. Year 2 starts in June. Horary starts in June. If you have a little prior traditional astrology experience, you might be interested in the Horary class, beautiful form of astrology. There's need-based tuition available. You can sign up on the website and pick the level or tier of monthly tuition that works for you if you are someone who doesn't have the means to sign up at our normal rate. So be sure to check that out. And I hope to see some of you in class soon, and I hope you guys are having a good week. We'll have more tomorrow. Bye, everyone. Hey, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. I'm going to tell you a little bit about our upcoming program, Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystic, my year one course in ancient Hellenistic astrology that begins on June 16th. If you'd like to learn more about it, of course, you can always do some digging and looking at the course page on your own. I'll take you over there right now and walk you through it. But if you want to, you can go over yourself and look. Nightlightastrology.com is the website. Click on the courses tab and go to the first year course. This is the one that begins on June 16th, the perfect place to start for people who would like to learn more about natal astrology from the Hellenistic point of view. So this is a one-year course in Hellenistic astrology, which is the oldest form of astrology, and it is the form from which all subsequent forms of astrology come from. It shares a lot in its roots with ancient Indian astrology. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what characterizes Hellenistic astrology, but just to familiarize you with this page, when you go to the first year course page and scroll down, you can learn more about everything that's included in the course. Some of the main features include 30 classes on the year. These classes are spread out through units of curriculum. And in between the major units of curriculum, we have breakout study sessions led by our tutoring staff. We also have an interactive group forum discussion that is staffed with tutors year round. You always get your questions answered within 24 hours. So there's a lot of support built into the program as we work our way through the curriculum. We also have recommended reading, listening, optional quizzes, flashcards, bonus lectures, more than you could possibly read in a year, honestly. So we just have a large and long biography and sort of library of suggested bonus content that will fill in blanks and also supplement and deepen the material that we are studying. You get lifetime access to all the recordings. If you cannot attend the webinars live, they meet on the weekends. But if you can't attend them live, then you are welcome to follow along with the recordings, which are made available to you on the class website. So this class meets on Sundays from noon Central to 2 p.m. Central, or 1 Eastern to 3 p.m. Eastern time. And you might translate that, I guess, if you're on the West Coast, it would be what, 10 a.m. to noon Pacific time. During the program, in addition to working our way through all of the major curriculum, the major foundational elements of Hellenistic astrology, we place a strong emphasis on preparing ourselves to read charts for other people. Whether this is a hobby for you or something that you are endeavoring to practice professionally, the course is built for people who are really there for a lot of different reasons. This is your hobby. This is your passion. You hope to do this for really no one other than yourself, or maybe friends or family, or someone who really decides they want to start a practice. You can take this class at whatever level of interest or depth that you want because of the amount of material that we make available to you inside and outside of class. You always have access to the program too, so you can always, you know, take it at your own pace. You can attend live, follow along with the recordings, some combination of both. And then the breakout study sessions are really helpful in addition to our interactive group forum discussion. You can always ask us questions. You can email me anytime with questions. So we have a lot of support in place. Now, the curriculum, we move through the foundational elements of ancient astrology. You may look at the curriculum and say, well, I know something about these things already, but not really, unless you've studied Hellenistic astrology, because the way that ancient astrologers talked about houses, signs, planets, aspects, essential dignities, chart delineation is radically different from what most people learn when they start studying modern astrology. The reason for that is that it's only been in the past couple of decades that we have finally had access to the vast majority of ancient texts on Hellenistic astrology. We were literally missing the bulk of our ancient tradition. So the kind of rebirth or reawakening of ancient astrology is really new, which makes this very exciting, because everything you've learned in modern astrology is probably coming from the lens of what is called psychological astrology, which is a way of looking at the birth chart in terms of the planet signs, houses, and the way in which they may relate to your psychological makeup or profile. In this way, birth charts are a little bit like an elaborate Myers-Briggs. So you have the personality profiling, which is the way that most people look at planets, houses, and signs. You'll notice they have my Mars, my Venus, and they think of them as aspects or dimensions of your character and personality. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, we utilize much of the same language, and we certainly have that approach available to us in this program because ancient astrologers also looked at the chart in terms of psychological makeup. However, one of the main distinctions between modern astrology and ancient astrology is the emphasis that ancient astrologers placed on prediction. They looked at the chart in terms of a field of karma that defines the native or the individual's fate or destiny. And so we look at houses, signs, planets, aspects as a way of understanding what patterns, themes, and topics are going to be most prevalent and at what times, because they also had a very elaborate system of timing techniques. The year one program is all about learning to read the birth chart and understanding the ancient hermetic, sort of Platonic Pythagorean philosophy that was behind the establishment of all of the doctrines and teachings of astrology itself. So it's really about understanding where everything comes from. It's the why behind everything that greatly empowers people when they're learning astrology. It is not nearly the same when you just study lists of adjectives and descriptions for houses, signs, planets, aspects. We want to understand why. Why do we do these things at all? Where did it all come from? And when you understand that, then you have something like a skeleton key by means of which you can access your own creativity, your own intuition, rather than being told, just play these notes in this order and it will sound good. You're learning to improvise, which, you know, could anyone ever want to play? Why would you want to play an instrument if someone told you, well, here's how to play. Play this, play this, play that. And you never learned how to play something of your own, or you never learned how to use the scales in ways that were magical and, pertain to your own genie, your own genius. So when we study ancient astrology, one of the main things we're doing is we're taking people beyond anything that they think they've learned about houses, signs, planets, aspects, and we're teaching them where it all came from. And once you have that, then you're really cooking with fire. You have a magical intuitive capacity that is very rare and precious in astrology. So anyway, we move through a lot of different elements, but not in the way that you've ever learned them before. And that's a really important distinction. So anyway, after all of that has been said, in each unit, we spend, maybe up to 10 hours on houses. And then we have a breakout study session. And then we have reading and bonus material. So when we talk about houses in this class, you are learning where the concept of a house ever came from in the first place, what it is, how it works, and how it's different from a sign. You're also going to unlearn and break a lot of bad habits, because not by any intentional ignorance, but modern astrology, being bereft of its ancient textual tradition, has been teaching a lot of things that are just not in line with where the actual theoretical foundations of astrology come from. So you're also going to break some bad habits, which is really good for people who maybe know a little bit about astrology already, but are seeking to clarify and understand theory in the context of the 2000 year history of astrology. So anyway, this class is going to prepare you to read birth charts for other people. But then by the end, one of the great things about the program is that the way we do that is not just by pumping you full of theory and history and philosophy. We are also, in the last portion of the program, inviting live clients into the class. And that's great, because when we have live clients come in, you're going to see me read from them using the theory and techniques that we've been studying. And you're going to see how they can be applied artfully, as well as giving you some tools and methods and techniques to use to set you up for success. Seeing live astrology practice while studying it is the best way to learn. So the last portion of the program, we turn toward that hands-on approach. Anyway, so that's a bit about the program. If you have any questions you want to ask, email us info@nightlightastrology.com. We're happy to answer any questions you have whatsoever. I also want to point people to the payment options at the bottom. Early bird payment saves you $500 off. That is a great way to save. The payment plan is breaking the tuition into 12 monthly installments. If that works better for you, no worries, you can do that. And then need-based tuition. We, for many, many years now, dating back to 2010 when I started teaching astrology, I've always had some kind of sliding scale option available for people when studying astrology. Sacred science like this should be accessible to people of all different socioeconomic backgrounds. So we pride ourselves on making sure that there is tuition assistance available, so that if your budget doesn't match with the payment price that we ask for, and that's an honest assessment that we trust you to make, that you can take advantage of the tuition assistance and set your price within a sliding scale that we provide for your monthly tuition for 12 months through the program. So please feel free to apply for that if it makes sense to you. We don't want people hurting themselves or overextending themselves. A price that fits your budget is available through the need-based tuition. We just ask that you apply early, because we do fill up sometimes. So anyway, that is it. I hope that you will consider studying with us, and thanks for taking time to learn more about the program. See you later.